Fables are ancient tools for delivering big lessons to human audiences. Today's guest applies modern storytelling technology to this ancient tradition. He's Kerry Kirkpatrick this week on Story in the Public Square. Welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Joining me, as he always does, is my great friend and colleague, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Every week, we sit down with the best storytellers around, filmmakers, authors, journalists, and more, to make sense of the big stories shaping public life in the United States today. Today, we're joined by a talented filmmaker, producer, director, and composer. You might know him for his 2018 smash hit, Smallfoot. It's Kerry Kirkpatrick. Thank you so much for being with us, Kerry.
My pleasure.
So, you know, we want to talk to you about your films and your other work, but I'm really curious about how you charted this course to where you are today. How'd you get into filmmaking? How'd you get into the sort of creative arts in the first place?
Well, I was always a creative kid. I used to sing at, my dad was a minister of music at our Baptist church. So I got trotted up on stage a lot to sing and started there and then got interested in school. And really by age 14, I think I did my first play and kind of started ODing on theater and was pursuing acting until I was about, I would say 20. But within that pursuit, I always had ideas, just always. And early on was writing things for me to perform. And then I was working at Disney World doing improvisational street theater and decided I really wanted to pursue writing. So I applied to the USC Film School and moved to Los Angeles to go to film school. And then while I was in film school, I took a trip down to San Diego to see the world premiere out-of-town tryout of Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods, which was at the Old Globe Theater in San Diego. And on the drive back, me and my then writing partner were talking about really wanting to write musicals and trying to figure out how could we do that and get paid. And we kind of came up with an idea on that drive from San Diego to LA of an, we decided the answer was Disney music, Disney animation. And I grew up watching Disney animation and in particular musicals. And so we came up with an idea and wrote it and then did a staged reading of it with the songs and someone at Disney that I kind of saw it and put us in touch with the head of development there. And we went and pitched and they didn't like the idea, but they thought it was rare to have a team that wrote screenplay, music, and lyrics. And so they hired us to be summer interns. And we were writing things like Mickey Mouse featurettes, you know, like Mickey does the classics. We wrote My Fair Goofy with Mickey and Goofy and Mickey and the Emperor's New Clothes and things like that. And then towards the end of that internship, they put us on The Rescuers Down Under. Yeah. Which also at the time was going to have songs in it. So we were rewriting on Rescuers and writing songs for it as well.
How old are you when this happens?
I am 23.
23. So the idea of having sort of your hands around this incredible icon, Mickey Mouse, does that faze you as a 23-year-old, or is it just sort of, well, this is what's next?
It was great. It was like, I mean, not only, yeah, it was great to be at Disney and, you know, have a silver pass to Disneyland, which was great. It was just such a great kind of boot camp for writing because I was a staff writer. I mean, you come in every day and what's my assignment for the day? And so I'm just writing and writing constantly. And yeah, and for something that is pretty high profile. So it was weird. I mean, I was writing the not only Mickey, but like we wrote Mickey and Minnie. It was like a cotton club kind of, it was called Mickey's Valentine, but it was sort of like a cotton club spinoff, and wrote about six songs for that. And so it was, I mean, it turned into a 3-year staff writing deal. And after working on Rescuers, we wrote another musical and developed just a lot of things. Literally, my job would be I'd come in and it would be like, hey, Michael Eisner has an idea to do Romeo and Juliet with red ants and black ants. And, for a month, that would be my job, just to try to develop, stories like that. And being surrounded by incredibly creative people, because in animation is kind of a really unique experience and process, because storyboard artists are a really essential part of the animation process. So writers have to learn how to work with storyboard artists as you create what we call a story reel or an animatic, which is really where the story kind of takes over. It finds its form, is that you are, it's pencil drawings that they cut together, and then you get to watch it, and it goes through several iterations. And so that process is unique. It's exhausting. You write a lot of pages, you try a lot of things, and it's super collaborative. So spending 3 years working in that process kind of gave me, at an early age, a unique marketable skill set that then moved me on to other animated films. So that's, ultimately how I moved into James and the Giant Peach. And then the exec producer on James and the Giant Peach had just made a deal with Aardman, and that led to Chicken Run. And Chicken Run kind of reintroduced me to Jeffrey Katzenberg, who was just starting DreamWorks. And then that led to a 20-year deal with DreamWorks, where I worked on all the other animated things that I did, from Over the Hedge to, I worked on Spirit, I worked on Madagascar, I worked on the first draft of Kung Fu Panda. I mean, I was just sort of in the DreamWorks family. And if I wasn't spearheading a show, then I was either being a creative consultant or chiming in, being in a writer's room. So, and I haven't done animation exclusively, but once you've worked in it and get a feel for the process, it becomes a valuable selling tool for you as a writer and ultimately a director.
I have to imagine that it's also just an enormous amount of fun.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it exhausts a lot of writers, because it's a lot of writing. I mean, I was on Chicken Run for 3.5 years, and probably in the neighborhood of about 5,000 pages, I would say, of just constant trial and error. And so writing for animation is a marathon. It's not a sprint. And I actually learned, I learned how to work within that process really well, and learned to like it, because it becomes somewhat of a workshop kind of environment, I guess. I mean, honestly, it's, I love collaborating. I'm not a sit in a cabin by a lake and write kind of guy. Me alone with my thoughts is, that's where procrastination creeps in. And I tend to get my best ideas while talking out loud, and bouncing off of other people and feeding off of other people's creative energy. And that happens a lot in animation. I work with writing partners a lot, and
So I'm hearing from you very clearly a very strong work ethic, but also collaboration. And does that go back to your childhood? Your brother Wayne has been a partner in some of your projects. Did
Right.
is that where the collaboration began? And tell us about that part of your childhood. He's older than you, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I have two brothers, and I have a younger brother, Brent, who's also very creative. And we grew up like kids do. We had a little tape recorder. We used to make radio shows, and people I've known all my life, and we were always making things up. To move that into a professional arena was kind of a natural process. And from an early age, I mean, when I was in right out of high school, me and Wayne and this guy Byron Simpson, who was the guy I went to see Into the Woods with, we had an idea for a musical, a stage musical, and wrote it, and it wasn't very good. Because we were making a lot of sort of rookie mistakes. But that was, Wayne was a songwriter, and I was, coming out of acting and dramatic writing, and it made a lot of sense. So that would have been 1984 that we were working on that. When I went off to film school, I had a couple. Wayne would have an idea for a movie. We wrote it together. We wrote a couple of screenplays together, and that took us up to like 19. Literally 1996, kicking ideas back and forth. And 96 was when we came up with the idea for Something Rotten, which, made its way to Broadway by 2015. That's how long it took for that idea to kind of come to fruition, of he and I just kicking stuff around. And part of that was because, by this point he's got a really successful songwriting career and record producing career going, and my screenwriting career was taking off, and so we were kind of taking turns not being available because of whatever project we were involved with. And but we're all creative people, and it's impossible that we just don't get together and exchange ideas. And we kind of speak the same language and have the same sensibility. And I'm pretty lucky that my brother is such a talented songwriter and lyricist, and it just was a natural, kind of a natural partnership that formed.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard 4 times every weekend on SiriusXM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a great crew at Rhode Island PBS. We're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me, as he does every week in the co-host chair, is my friend G. Wayne Miller, who's an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal and the author of 17 books. You can find Wayne on Twitter too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is Carey Kirkpatrick. He's a multi-talented screenwriter, composer, and filmmaker. You might know him for the 2018 animated classic Smallfoot. And you can find Carey on Twitter at Carey Kirk, KareyKirk.
Do you ever give any thought, do you reflect on or ponder where imagination and making things up and creativity comes from? Like what part of the brain is it? Are you born with it? Do you learn it? It's a question I'm asked occasionally, and I never really come up with a great answer because I
I
do
wish
a lot of, go ahead.
I do. I wish I had a. I don't know. I mean, to me, it's sort of like, for me, it's like eye color. It's like, well, it's on my eyes have always been blue, so I can't rem I don't know. I will say I think most kids have natural creative instincts, make believe time, play time. And it's sometimes I often think that there is a fork in the road where, and it kind of takes some really supportive parents to go, yeah, you can do that. That could be a career. Why not? And I'm always thankful for that. I always say there's kind of two kinds of people in the world. There are people who do things either because of or in spite of their parents. And I know a lot of creative people who do it in spite of. You know, they have parents who said, "This is insane." I'm not one of those. You know, me and my brothers are lucky that my parents were like, "Hey, if this is what makes you happy, you know, pursue it." And so I just know I am somebody who I always, I can't remember a time when I just haven't had ideas of, and it's not just story ideas. I was telling my kids the other day, it was like, I remember I grew up in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and a giant a Sears shut down or something like that, and it was in a big two-story department store building, and it was sitting there, and they were wondering what they were going to do with it. And I had an idea to turn the whole inside of Sears into a motocross bicycle racing track.
Love
And
that idea.
because I was riding, you know, I had a motocross BMX bike, so that's what I was doing. And you know, we were always making jumps. And in my head, I was like, oh, the escalators would be like you ride up and you ride down and you bring a bunch of dirt in. And I drew this up and literally go to my dad and I'm like, who do we know is, you know, that we can go pitch this to? And it's sort of like, you know, that's a bit of an insane idea, but that's just how I thought as a kid.
It's
I
also, I
mean,
mean, it's not just creative, it's also a little entrepreneurial.
oh, yeah, totally. And I've always been pretty entrepreneurial. But, and I will say, if somebody said to me, they're never gonna turn a Sears into a, my answer would be, why not? Like, why not? Why is this a bad idea? And so the one of my mantras in my whole career has been, well, somebody gets to do this, why not me? I mean, why is this career exclusive to, you know, to other people that aren't me? And it's not. So, and I know a lot of people, I mean, and I ran into this when even when I was living in Orlando. I remember I applied to USC Film School and my roommate, one of my roommates, because I had three, said to me, do you know how many people go out there and try to be a screenwriter and how many actually make it? You know, and it would whatever it was, one out of every 100,000. And my answer was, yeah, I'll be that one.
Well, and here you are.
Well, and it's like, and I really hate, I don't, I hate the odds. I hate bringing the odds into something that has, you know, to do with passion and, you know, where it's like, yeah, it's hard, but that's not a reason why you shouldn't try. And again, well, somebody gets to do it, and why not me? Why am I not qualified? You know? And I think a lot of times people tend to think, oh, you're just a kid from Baton Rouge, you know, like, but I'm like, well, everyone's from somewhere, and you don't have to be from LA or New York or London to be cool and have ideas. In fact, so many of the greats are from little places where there's nothing to do but imagine things. So yeah, that's kind of how my whole career has been.
Well, so we want to talk a little bit about Smallfoot, which I have to tell you, I absolutely loved.
Great.
And I watched it again recently to get ready for this interview. I want to talk to you a little bit about the story itself, but how did you come to be involved in that project?
That one was so the producer on that, a woman named Bonnie Radford, who's a very experienced animation producer. I met her while I was at DreamWorks. She produced a DreamWorks movie called Spirit, Stallion of the Cimarron, and I did some writing on that. And then Bonnie went off and produced Curious George. And what tends to happen a lot in animation is a lot of writers get brought in a lot of times to punch up. You know, like I told you, it's kind of an exhausting process, and a lot of writers run out of steam. So Bonnie brought me in on Curious George and a couple of things that she was doing. So she was on Smallfoot, called me to see if I was available. That it needed some writing help. And I had a little time, so I went in with a guy I was writing with named Chris Poche. We met. I had worked with the head of Warner Brothers before, Courtney Valenti, on another animated thing. So I pitched out my ideas. They hired me really to come in and just do a bit of a rewrite. There was another director on the movie at the time. By the way, this also happens somewhat frequently in animation too, where there'll be one director on and then either their vision doesn't sync up with the studio's vision, or it's the things change. And in this case, the entire leadership at Warner Brothers changed, right? And that when that happens, sometimes it's like, oh yeah, I don't want that version. So what ended up happening was I kind of came in and gave the story a bit of a reset. And because Bonnie had worked with me, because the guy who was directing was a first-time director, they asked me to kind of play a larger supervisory role. And to kind of help in the edit room. And then they asked if I would, because I'd had a lot of experience working with actors, if I would be at the recording sessions as well. And then it's like, well, that starts to get a little dicey when you're the executive producer. I mean, actors really want to listen to the director, and they were like, all right, maybe we should make you the co-director. And then eventually, vision just started shifting a little bit more to where I was more organically in the driver's seat, and they said, we think you should probably just direct it. And I wasn't, honestly, I wasn't quite sure that I wanted to make that kind of time commitment, but I did, and I especially got interested when they wanted to make it a musical. So, and
So
then.
it is it's a remarkable story. It's a modern fable in a lot of
It is
respects,
very much, yeah.
where the animals are sort of looking at, or the creatures are looking at people. But there's a clear sort of there's several messages there that I found really, really provocative and compelling. When you take on a project like that, are you at all apprehensive about telling a story that is intentional in wanting to say something big?
Well, I really think what happens is, when you're a writer, a visual artist, storyboard artist, just any kind of creative person, it's kind of impossible to not, whatever world you're living in and things that are going on in the world, it's impossible for you to not have feelings and thoughts about them, and it's almost impossible for them to not kind of leak into whatever it is that you're creating. And it just so happened that when I came onto Smallfoot, I mean, that was sort of the summer or early 2016, and we were in the middle of a very contentious election cycle. And then the 2016 presidential election happened, and all of these issues were just in the zeitgeist. And the issues, a lot of the issues, if you kind of lump them together, they had to do with us and them. And we were all just kind of a, we all suddenly one day realized, all right, the premise of this story is, it's called Smallfoot, Bigfoot in reverse, right? We are the weird creatures that the Sasquatch, or the Yetis are looking at. And we humans, we have, it's a very ethnocentric kind of view, like that we kind of view this as like, this is our planet and everybody else is different. And so the role reversal of, all right, what must our ways look like to them? Which is why there's some jokes in the show about, like the things that they have found, a horn, a ski pole is a horn, and our favorite was, the scroll of invisible wisdom, which is toilet paper, with nothing written on it. And these were the jokes that kind of made it like you're right, when you look at us, we are weird. And we have some weird customs. So that's always a great kind of playground for comedy. But then, as poignancy, we're making it. There's, as you remember, there were a lot of hotbed topics that had to do with, there were migrants. There was a migrant issue around the world. There was talk of building a wall. And when we talked about that whole idea of, of building a wall, we realized that in Smallfoot, the stone keeper and this notion that they're on a mountain and they think they're the only ones, and there's this cloud, these clouds that we find out that they're making. It's like, well, that's our version of a wall. And it's like, to keep you on that side and to us over here, and that's the only way for us to coexist and be safe. That we started to realize, oh wow, we have a topical thing here, and we can lean into this, kind of make a nice statement about us versus them, not the right way to go, you know, and coexisting and cohabitating and seeing others for their differences is something that can sit underneath this. Not in a, we never ever wanted to sort of get behind a pulpit and be preachy about it, because we wanted it to be a comical, but what's really nice, and I'll tell you, the we spent years, literally years, talking about how this movie, that movie ended. And we always thought the ending would be that humans came up there through the clouds and kind of observe the Yetis. And one of our storyboard artists kept hounding on me. It's like, I don't think that's the right ending. And we had written this song. Wayne and I wrote a song called Moment of Truth. And people heard the song. And the storyboard artist just went off and he said, I have an idea for the ending that's completely nonverbal. It just goes with the song. And he boarded that whole thing of the song starting, Yetis going to the edge of the mountain, the clouds part, for the first time Yetis see a whole world out there, and then go down the mountain and Yetis and humans meeting and one stepping forward, you know, and it's like the whole thing being done visually. I wish I could take credit for it, but it was this one storyboard artist named Max, and when he just showed it to me, I was like, well, that's it. And it just had such a simple poignancy to it. And I think what's nice about it is, you know, the nicest comment that I've gotten about Smallfoot is people seeing and that at the end going, wow, there was more there than I thought was going to be there.
Well, you know, that scene actually made me cry the first time I saw it, and it moved me the second time I saw it too. Carrie, I hate to say this, but we're out of time. We could talk to you all day, but we thank you for joining us. That is all the time we have for Story in the Public Square. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.